Hello and welcome to Radio Reading Services and the Smithsonian Magazine for July and August 2019. I am your host, Gail Fisher. We're going to pick up and continue the article written by William T. Volman entitled Melville's Last Paradise. Our author took an improbable voyage in search of the misunderstood author of America's greatest epic adventure. Mr. Volman has his article broken up in what I would call chapters, and we're going to start with chapter 6 today. We re-entered Jean-Pierre's truck and drove to a lonely spot in the jungle, approaching the site where Melville might have lived with Pa'ue among the Taipei. Entering the mid-morning steam bath, I telescoped my segmented walking stick and launched into another Marquesian perspiration. Jean-Pierre was warning about the mosquitoes. Beaucoup de dégâts, he laughed. Nearly everybody I asked in the Marquesas had suffered at least one visitation of the fever. Then we walked down a hill track that quickly petered out into shrubbery. In 10 minutes, we reached our destination, which, according to Taipei, lay about halfway up the ascent of a rather abrupt rise of the ground, where a number of large stones were laid to the height of nearly 8 feet. At no great distance flowed the Wai Ai Niul River, evidently the stream in which Tomo and Piu bathed for half an hour each morning. So far, topography corresponded to description, and there, at the right angle to the slope, rose a flat-topped boulder eminence of approximately 8 feet. Its Taipei name is transliterated by Melville, was a pipi or paipai. Upon it would have risen some family house, whose bamboo frame and hibiscus wood transverses were, of course, long gone. Jean-Pierre said that this tohua, a central cleared area for clan festivities that at one end might include a place for human sacrifice, had been abandoned generations ago due to malaria before the dengue fever came. How do you know this was the Melville site? Because my grandfather told me, Jean-Pierre said. Mostly the tohoa was a jumble of rocks, the ground overgrown to an ankle's thickness by an ivish plant that had been imported from New Zealand to feed the cows. Here, where Melville and Pau used to stroll along, sometimes hand in hand, with perfect charity for all, and especially goodwill towards each other, I took my promenade, until Jean-Pierre warned me against falling coconuts. In 2007, a tourist and her guide were killed by them at a scenic waterfall nearby. Sitting on a mossy, wet boulder, I gazed down at a steep wall of rocks to the river. My knees were glowing with bites. Below was a pavement of white, lichened boulders, and the lovely breeze and the brown-green Wai Niul, a rapid creek. In its flow, the waiting Taipei maidens used to soak their coconut shells and polish them with stones. I picked a hard green lime from its thorny branch. It was very fragrant. When we stopped for a cheese and cracker lunch, Jean-Pierre cut it for me with his machete, so that I could squeeze it into my water bottle. Chapter 7. One of the characteristics of Taipei most offensive to 19th-century Americans was its unashamed eroticism. Another was Melville's rage against the missionaries. When he began composing it, he, quote, went far indeed, implanting not just sensuous but actually obscene passages in his decorous manuscript, writes his biographer Herschel Parker. Omitting those, let us content ourselves with lesser innuendos. Quoting, Bathing in company with troops of girls formed one of my chief amusements. And there was a tenderness in her manner that was impossible to misunderstand or resist. Every evening the girls of the house would anoint my whole body.
Your whole body, Herman?
With a fragrant oil squeezed from a yellow root. End quotes. Our hero was apparently living easily. And then what? Just as the red, white, yellow, and green flower garland that my Taihua femme de menage, Isabel, draped around my neck smelled so spearmint bright at first, then wilted and began to stink. Just so it was, my friends, for poor old Tomo. You see, he kept worrying that his Taipei hosts would eat him. What if those ill thoughts were mere embellishments, and the simple truth was that the joy had drained from his sojourn at Taipei? The gods themselves are not forever glad, he writes in Moby Dick. The ineffaceable, sad birthmark on the brow of man is but the stamp of sorrow in the signers. Most likely is that being ignorant of the Marquesian language and culture, he simply did not know whether he was on the menu. Chapter 8. Let me describe a certain weird old ruin on the far side of the island. A honey smell came in the evening breeze, and I heard a crow-like croaking. Palms bent together and whispered behind the long, low walls of a wide-stepped terrace. I heard a fluttering sound. Then a bird began cawing, "Wah!" And everything stayed motionless on the black basalt platforms. In the humid twilight, the platforms with their white lichen began to look sinister. My eye was held by a single banyan tree, maybe 500 years old, which sprang upward like some grisly and sacred entity upon an altar. The clouds darkened, the terraces were already silhouettes, the leaves began to go utterly dark. By the time the Jean-Pierre led me to it, the site's famous petroglyph boulder could barely be seen. Of its descriptions, I most remember the great turtle, represented because turtles come from the sea to lay eggs, then perish. Hence, after we die, our spirit goes likewise to the sea. Thus, the artist might have believed, Jean-Pierre said, maybe 1,000 years after Christ. Feeling my way with my walking stick, I tapped from boulder to boulder. Jean-Pierre pointed into a deep pit, dark against the darkness, which he called the ancient calaboose. Really, it was more like a meat locker, the place where captured enemy warriors were kept until eating time. Imagine being a lonely guest near any such place, and every clan had one, among people with whom one could scarcely communicate. How could Melville know that the smile of Peru really signified, or whether Cory Cory, his gentle manservant, might suddenly take on a butcher's role? Chapter 9. All we know of his escape, overwrought in Taipei, which is not to say false, the indigenous may have peacefully traded him back to the Europeans, is that in August 1842, our author ended up on the whaler Lucy Ann, an adventure he drew on for Taipei's sequel, Omu. Shorthanded, thanks to desertions, the ship's captain rescued Melville, who signed on to cruise as far as Tahiti. Reasonably fearful of more desertions at Tahiti, the captain forbade his men shore leave. Thus did Melville, insubordinate as always, join a mutiny. It failed. In Tahiti, they threw him in Calabuza Berettini, Melville's transliteration, which in Tahitian means English jail. I would have liked to have seen this place, but nothing remained of it. Our author had his little ways. Soon his confinement was relaxed, then remitted, and he found himself a vagrant once again. In the time he was in Tahiti, he observed white missionaries invading people's homes at mealtimes, while native constables dragooned whomever they could catch to Sunday services. The new moral code was punitively enforced. The education system was a sort of apartheid. Omu bitterly describes the cane-thumping old missionaries at whose sight the natives slink into their huts. Melville could only conclude that the Tahitians are worse off now for the encounter. In Papeete, French Polynesia's capital on Tahiti, my pension host, Luc Francois, did not disagree with Melville. I wish the missionaries stay at home, because they say their God is better than other God. He laughed. They say, now you have to pray to my God. You have to put on a dress. You have to hide a tattoo. But my tattoo is my clan's story, my children's story. But they say, my God don't like. We are a small place, a small piece of the universe. Why come to me and say like that? With native culture changed, Melville concluded that the islanders' prospects are hopeless. The English language guidebook, whose job it was to entice me here so that I could inflict my own mite of cultural damage, admitted that domestic violence and incest are prevalent. This is closely connected with high rates of alcoholism. Little progress has been made. I found the guidebook's final assessment off the mark. For one thing, Tahiti's inhabitants, about 9,000 according to Melville, now numbered nearly 200,000. Some of them smiled at me, right there in Papeete's motionless, humid shadows, with traffic soft hum all around me as I sat in a grove of palm trees, entertaining people with my compliments in bad French. At night, they danced for each other, not for money. Their language still lived. Chapter 10. Around November 1842, Melville decamped for the island of Moria, finding himself pressed into unhappy work. Digging potatoes, he decided to visit a village called Tamay, where dwelt the most beautiful and unsophisticated women. For the sake of scholarship, I tootled over to Tamay, now orthographized Tamay, and in a different part of the island than where Melville had put it. He spoke of a lake. Yes, I did see a body of brackish water beside the airport. Its shallows were stringy with algae and littered with rotting coconuts. Some days, after viewing the passionate movements with throbbing bosoms of those Tamay sylphs, Melville received warning that the law was coming. Fearing that he would be arrested for vagrancy, he had to clear out. I next lay down in a concrete pavilion by the turquoise ocean with its reef line just before the horizon. 10 days after fleeing the constables at Tamay, Melville marched into this exact spot. He was expert as ever at accepting the hospitality of Polynesians. Bathed, sated, and dressed, he took the time to admire coconut oil burning inside a lamp made from half a green melon, a soft, dreamy light being shed through the transparent rind. And here I want to say that so much of his Polynesian writings have to do, as well as they should, with the pleasures of idleness and even somnolence. The slender, middle-aged Papeetean lady, whose machete opened a juiced coconut for me, had never heard of Melville. She wondered if that might be my name. The radio was playing an old song I always liked about going to San Francisco. On the way out of town, a sign warned of false prophets. Chapter 11. Finally, Melville shipped out on the whaler Charles and Henry. Sometime between January and March 1843, he arrived in Hawaii, then called the Sandwich Islands. Most of his doings there cannot be verified. He might have landed at Lahaina. We know he passed some time in Honolulu, where he signed a one-year contract to work as an Englishman's bookkeeper. Meanwhile, the Acushnet, which had also arrived in Hawaii, posted a complaint of desertion against him. In August 1843, having characteristically broken his contract, Melville enlisted on the USS United States. They landed in Nuku, Hawaii, in October, then came a week anchored just off Tahiti, and that was the last he ever saw of Polynesia. By now, the shy young innocent had found his sea legs. He could defy, desert, blaspheme, and fornicate with the best. He had grown comfortable with the fact that from the wild life they lead, sailors as a class entertain the most liberal notions concerning morality and the décalogue. And indeed, as Charles Roberts Anderson rather sourly writes on in the last page of his 1939 tome, Melville in the South Seas. Within a decade, the high priest of the South Seas had become, in his own eyes at least, the heretic of an inquisitional civilization. Melville hated restrictions on his liberty, hence his mutinies and vagabondage. So he kept right on calling out authority, ranging ahead in a long cruise toward unfettered self-expression, which in our world naturally equals self-destructiveness. Of Hawaii, he wrote, "What has the savage to desire at the hand of civilization? Let the once smiling and populous Hawaiian islands with their now diseased, starving, and dying natives answer the question. The missionaries may seek to disguise the matter as they will, but the facts are incontrovertible." Defiant as always, with ever-growing daring in his style, he sailed in the direction of his unknown greatness. Chapter 12. And so he came home to his America, by no means to ours. Thrice happy are they who, inhabiting some yet undiscovered island, have never been brought into contaminating contact with the white man, runs Typee. It follows that he had contaminated them, and they most certainly did him the same favor. He wrote to Nathaniel Hawthorne, whom he adored, that he had no development at all until age 25, which is to say around 1844. In that year, he began to write Typee. The Harper brothers rejected it a year later. His brother, Gansevoort, who remained the family's support, carried it to the London publisher Murray, who printed it moderately bowdlerized in 1846. Almost immediately, thanks to the writer Washington Irving, Typee gained an American publisher, George Putnam. The first reviews were favorable, and no other book of his ever sold so well. It made him famous. But on March 14, a British periodical, The Critic, said, "Seldom have savages found so zealous a vindicator of their morals. Rarely, too, has Christianity owned so ungrateful a son." Although Typee and then Omu continued to garner praise, attacks on his Christianity, bolstered by Horace Greeley's denunciations of his hankering for the loose company, not always of the masculine order, began to undo Melville's career. When Gansevoort died suddenly in 1846, the young young author had to increase his efforts to support his penniless old mother. Fortunately, he had attracted the rich and pretty Elizabeth Shaw. What did she see in him? He was handsome, fascinating, a storyteller. He must have seemed someone of promise. In other words, he happened in that weird interlude between when he was forgetting Pailloux's excellence at playing the nose flute, which was scarcely yet imagining the long bulk of the white whale gliding toward the Pequod, to be capable of what most people call responsibility, end quote, quote and unquote. Pressured by his American publisher into reprinting Typee with numerous anti-missionary and erotic expurgations, he went along, hoping for some future income guarantee, for he craved to marry Lizzie, whose father did not intend to throw her into poverty. With that self-destructive defiance I love him for, he sharpened his harpoon against the missionaries quite gleefully in Omu. Nor did he desist. Herschel Parker writes that he finally settled his grudge against his Presbyterian accusers and tormentors in Chapter 10 of Moby Dick, in which Ishmael worships the cannibal Queequeg's wooden idol. But that actually settled nothing. Again and again, the great white whale of Judeo-Christian conformity smashed at his morals. Lizzie had hoped to marry Herman in church. But we all thought, she wrote in a letter, that if it were to get about previously that Typee was to be seen on such a day, a great crowd might rush out of mere curiosity, or worse. On August 7, 1847, 3 days after the wedding, the Daily Tribune chuckled, "Breach of promise, suit expected Mr. Herman Typee Omu Melville has recently been united in lawful wedlock to a young lady of Boston. The fair forsaken faraway will doubtless console herself by suing him." Chapter 13. The Melvilles lived on Lizzie's father's money to improve his reputation, which is to say his finances. In 1849, Herman rushed out Marty and Redburn, followed by White Jacket the next year, all tales of a novice at sea. These mollified if they did not excite reviewers. Mr. Melville seems likely to go ahead again, if he will only take time and pains and not overwrite himself. In the best fashion of any career suicide, he regarded both latter volumes with contempt, writing to Lizzie's father, who may not have been delighted to hear it, that it is my earnest desire to write those sort of books which are said to fail, quote unquote. As if to prove the point, he now commenced his deep dive. He wrote in an adulatory essay about Hawthorne's fiction, "Now it is the blackness in Hawthorne that so fixes and fascinated me. This blackness, it is that furnished the infinite obscure of his background, the background against which Shakespeare pays his grandest conceits." What grand conceit could gamble to most contrasting advantage against a black background? Something white? And why was this whiteness something to write about, to dread, to be haunted by? It could be, as Melville wrote in The Whiteness of the Whale, the famous 42nd chapter of his opus, that by its indefiniteness, it shadows forth the heartless voids and immensities of the universe, and thus stabs us from behind with the thought of annihilation. Who was Melville but a man impelled by the unknown? What remained for him but to voyage beyond everything to the place where infinity is nothingness, and black and white contain each other? By now the Melvilles had moved near the Hawthorns in the Berkshires, into the house they called Arrowhead. our hero mortgaged it twice over. And so the former sailor shut himself up tight. Years later, his widow remembered that he, quote, would sit at his desk all day long, not eating anything till 4 or 5 o'clock, then ride to the village after dark, would be up early and out walking before breakfast, end quote. All the while, he was borrowing money and more money, keeping his debts secret. What I feel most moved to write, that is banned. It will not pay, he wrote to Hawthorne. Yet, altogether, write the other way, I cannot. Then, for a brief moment, he blinked at what was immutably decreed, temporarily lost faith in his own Shakespeare black fatality, and added, so the product is a final hash, and all my books are blotches. By then, Moby Dick was getting set into type. Chapter 11. A certain underwater photographer photograph of my edition of the wreck of the whaleship Essex shows a sperm whale headed forward like a finned gray-green torpedo, its lower jaw a strangely narrow appendage to the underside of that vast and squarish head. Such was the whale that stove in the Essex. Such must have been the whale in Moby Dick, rushing to smash in everything so that Melville's greatness could come into glory. In our day, the inhabitants of a biologically diminished planet may feel more sympathy than awe for the unexampled, intelligent malignity of the famous white whale. But what makes him such a hauntingly great literary character is his utter, and therefore utterly unreadable, alienness, an infinite magnification of the exotic otherness that his creator had sought in the South Pacific. Toward that oncoming collision between the whale and the Pequod, Melville wrote his way forward, employing wife or sister as copyist, ducking his mother's monetary religiousness, going deeper and darker into the sea, so that in the end he could take us down with him. He maintained his defiance with a core that was strangely sweet. From Moby Dick, quoting, for as this appalling ocean surrounds the most verdant land, so in the soul of man there lies one insular Tahiti, full of peace and joy, but encompassed by all the horrors of the half-known life. God keep thee. Push not off from that isle. Thou canst never return. End quote. We've completed our time today reading this section of the article. On behalf of Radio Reading Services, this has been Gail Fisher. Thank you so much for listening and welcoming us into your homes. We'll pick this up next week and finish it off. Have a great week.